But in double-crossing Pisistratus, the Alcmaeonids had sorely underestimated their man. Indeed, they had provided him with an invaluable masterclass in the darker political arts. Somehow, persuading the jilted Timonassa to return to him, Pisistratus also succeeded in patching up his friendship with her relatives back in Argos. Wealthy backers in Thebes were similarly charmed into giving him sponsorship. A fortune was raised, and an invasion force recruited. In 546 BC, Pisistratus landed on the shallow beaches at Marathon. His army took the southern road around Mount Pentelicon, and the engagement, when it came, was a rout. The surviving members of the Alcmaeonid family fled across the Attic border, exiles once again. Pisistratus once again climbed the great ramp to the Acropolis and took possession. He then informed his fellow citizens that they should not be alarmed or downcast, but should go and attend to their private business, leaving all the burdens of state for him to shoulder. The Athenians did as their new master had instructed, and Pisistratus, with a silky ruthlessness, alternately menaced and lulled his fellow Eupatrids into an unprecedented docility. The children of prominent rivals were packed off as hostages. Slaves from the savage steppes of Scythia appeared suddenly on patrol in the streets. Yet Pisistratus, even as he kept the city's richest pickings for himself, was careful also to throw his rivals the occasional juicy scrap. Miltiades, for instance, head of the Phylaids, was given permission to lead an expedition across the Aegean to the Hellespont, the narrow strait which divides Asia from Europe. He landed on the Chersonese, the thin peninsula which forms the European bank of the strait, and from which access to the Black Sea and its corn-gold shores could easily be controlled. There he threw himself into a brisk war of pacification. Then settled down, with Pisistratus' blessing, to establish a tyranny of his own. Meanwhile, in Athens, builders were set to work on the construction of a spectacular new square at the foot of the Acropolis, one that would soon sound to fresh water, bubbling from nine fountains, and gleam with the brilliance of freshly chiselled marble. How could any Athenian have any doubts about the tyrant's greatness or his beneficence? There was certainly little enthusiasm for any talk of liberty. In the spring of 527 BC, when Pisistratus finally passed away peacefully in his own bed, his two sons, Hippias and Hipparchus, succeeded without challenge to his 19-year reign of peace. The two brothers embarked upon an even more ambitious showcase, a temple to Zeus so breathtakingly vast that philosophers, goggling at the sight centuries later, would compare it to the pyramids. But Hippias and Hipparchus were no pharaohs. It was one thing for them to indulge in the enthusiasm for architecture that had always been expected of the upwardly mobile Eupatrid, but it was quite another to flaunt the basis and true character of their power. The Pisistratids had to veil as well as publicize their tyranny. Candidates from families other than the Pisistratids continued to be permitted to run for the archonship. Most, of course, were the tyrant's placemen. Most, but by no means all. Two in particular leapt out at anybody scanning a list of the city's archons. One of these, startlingly, was a Miltiades, not the contemporary of Pisistratus, but his nephew, recently emerged as head of the Phylaids. Just above him was an even bigger jaw-dropper, an Alcmaeonid, no less, one Cleisthenes, restored both to Athens and to her highest office by the favour of the tyrants. Could the Alcmaeonids, those inveterate backstabbers, really have buried the hatchet? To rely upon their good faith was certainly a gamble. Sure enough, soon after Cleisthenes had served his term of office, he overplayed his hand and was forced back into exile. This was a perilous victory for the Pisistratids. The source of their legitimacy, after all, was their ability to keep peace and public order. Descend to faction fighting, and their grip on power would start to slip. While they could hardly permit popular unrest, neither, awkwardly, could they risk indulging in too much of the repression that might stem it.